afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Amy Phillips coming up for you. Have you checked out the price of lemons lately? They've been sky high since Christmas, but Queensland lemons are about to hit the market, and we'll hear if they will provide some reprieve. Dalby agents have yarded more than 8,000 head for their first cattle sale for the year today. More than 1,000 are going under the hammer at Charters Towers. Hot, dry weather is seeing sale yards being flooded with cattle. Animals then in a good season might have been kept at home.
The season's just not suitable for them, so there's not enough stuff on the ground for them to grow out on and, you know, reach their full potential. We sold the bulk of our heifers last year as well.
The big sell-off continues for a Quilpie grazier. Thanks for your company. But first up today, a large-scale search is continuing for a fisherman missing in waters off the Sunshine Coast. You may have heard in the news, our reporter Jodie Gunders has just got off the phone to get the latest from the ABC Sunshine Coast news reporter Tara Cassidy.
So there's a major search and rescue effort that's underway at the moment for a missing fisherman who fell off a commercial boat off the Sunshine Coast early this morning. It happened at about 3 a.m. when emergency crews were alerted. So the missing man is understood to be about 45 years old, and he went missing off a spanner crab fishing boat at the time, and it's called the Barramita Cay. He was actually with another fisherman at the time, the skipper of the boat, and who had actually had his 14-year-old son with him on the boat for his first deep water fishing trip, as far as we've been told. They've alerted the water police, who've then sent out their own crews, as well as Life Flight and other fishing vessels to try and look for the man. And this rescue effort has been going on now for many hours off Double Island Point, about 30 nautical miles offshore. At the moment, there's about 8 helicopters, 2 aircraft, 1 jet. I think the Westpac helicopter has also just been tasked to the job, as well as 2 water police vessels, fishing vessels, and the Coast Guard boat, all out looking for this man, hoping for a positive outcome.
Tara, what are the weather conditions like for the search?
At the moment, we've been told that it's quite calm, and we were told that initially, it's believed that at the time this man fell over, it was actually quite calm waters. So they are hopeful, but there's no news just as yet of any sightings of him.
Is it known whether he was wearing a personal flotation device?
No, it's not known if he was, but they did say the skipper had thrown something overboard to try and help him. They put lights on, I think it was a floating device, and they put lights on it as soon as they realised that he was overboard. So they have put something into the water, but whether he was able to actually use it, I don't think that's been confirmed. And they weren't able to confirm whether he was actually wearing any safety equipment just as of yet.
The fishing community is quite tight-knit. What is the feeling among his colleagues and fellow fishermen?
So far, the people we've spoken to, they're quite worried, but they're also hopeful. They said that he was quite an experienced fisherman. He wasn't new to this, so he's obviously got a lot of knowledge, and he would know what to do, I guess, in these kinds of situations if he was to fall overboard. So they're holding a lot of hope, but they are quite obviously worried that this is going on quite a number of hours that he's been out at sea by himself.
Tara, is there anything else that's known about the circumstances, about how he came to fall overboard?
So they're unsure how he's actually fallen, but they did say, the skipper that was on board at the time said that they were actually just drifting. They weren't in the middle of their work when this has occurred. They had just been drifting out at sea at the time in what they believe, what he'd said to be, was calm water. And since then, they've issued, obviously alerted rescue teams and police, and he's also issued an urgent pan radio alert, which has gone out to all the boat users across the Sunshine Coast, basically asking them to keep an eye out for this man while they travel through waters off Double Island Point and Rainbow Beach.
Tara Cassidy reporting for ABC News and speaking with Jodie Gunders. Our thoughts are with the entire fishing community as they search for that man.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
We're going to turn our attention to world news for a moment, and UK agriculture industries are worried that if the United Kingdom leaves the European Union without an exit deal, the country's agriculture and food supply could be thrown into crisis. Overnight, British MPs voted down Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit divorce deal. Australia's National Farmers Federation President Fiona Simpson says she has been speaking with her counterparts in the UK and believes a no-deal exit by March 29 could have wide-ranging consequences.
Look, at this stage, we just don't know. One of the few things we know for sure is that on the 29th of March 2019, the UK leaves the EU. And at that time, of course, any of the arrangements that the UK have through their membership of the EU with trading partners like Australia, for example, or other countries, they will all cease as well. So in the early stages, if there is not a deal negotiated between now and the 29th of March, we will face some major upheaval as a trading partner of both the EU. And I think one of our main tasks at the moment is to try and make sure, and government's task is to minimise any sort of that upheaval and get ready to work with the UK if they do end up exiting the EU without a deal on the 29th of March.
Which Australian industries do you think will be most affected in positive and perhaps negative ways?
Well, certainly I think there's some opportunities too if the UK does exit the EU without a deal, because obviously the UK used to be a major trading partner of Australia, despite the fact that we live a long way away and any freight costs are quite expensive. There's still those opportunities there that we can negotiate after the 29th of March if that's the case. But in the short term, industries, some industries do export a lot of goods over there, and industries like the wine industry, for example, must be very nervous at the moment with all the uncertainty that is over there. And I think that's why the Australian government is doing a good job at making sure they can be ready with potentially duplicate sort of agreements that we already have with the EU at the moment covers the UK, but would need to be put in front of the UK if they exit without a deal on the 29th of March. Ready so that there's no break in our supply that we have over there.
Do you see that there could be perhaps a shortfall in food imported into the UK in that crossover time if there isn't any negotiations done between now and the 29th of March?
Certainly. I was in London as Theresa May presented the first Brexit deal to Parliament at the end of November, and spoke with a number of stakeholders over there, including the Food and Beverage Organisation and agricultural leaders. They are all preparing for a massive crisis, a crisis perhaps equaling and compared to the crisis of the war, in terms of being able to get goods and people to and from Europe and the UK, and to be able to prepare to have enough stock on hand in the UK if the borders are closed. Those sorts of preparations are now underway. I think people are treating this situation very, very seriously. The UK government is running out of time to negotiate the deal. And it's a really tense time. I've spoken with my farming leaders in Ireland and the UK. A very tense time for them and their members. I've assured them that we Australian farmers understand how they feel, having experienced a similar thing back in the 70s, but now are ready and standing ready to talk and help in any way that we can. And long term, look, there could be some good things that come out of being able to rebuild our relationship with the UK again as a standalone trading partner.
Do you see the UK, though, perhaps encroaching on some of the markets that Australia has developed as another premium producer of certain products?
Yes, certainly. I think they have produce that they want to send as well. And the essence of trade, of course, is being able to export and import goods. So I'm sure that there are goods that they will want to increase as the supply of to Australia as well. And that's all part of the negotiating process. I know the UK are very, very proud of their, and Ireland, very proud of the lamb and the red meat, the beef that they produce. Also, you know, obviously dairy is quite a big product as well. So I think in terms of the quantities, I'm not sure of those, but I think certainly if we approach negotiations in terms of a win-win, then that's always the right way to go.
Always interesting. Fiona Simpson, National Farmers Federation President, speaking with Cassie Huff. It'll be fascinating to see what happens come March. Now to the US, and in a speech to the nation's farmers, President Donald Trump has talked up a need for a wall on the Mexico border, but also the need to break down trade barriers and bad deals with other nations. At the American Farm Bureau Federation's 100th annual convention, I can imagine that's a big deal, Mr. Trump highlighted the benefits of his government's recently signed farm bill and assured the audience their greatest harvest was yet to come. Matt Brand reports.
I like the farmers. What can I do? I like farmers. Thank you. Thank you.
America's trade war with China has hurt the hip pockets of many US farmers. And in his speech, President Trump gave little hope of a quick resolution. He was, however, keen to talk up other more positive trade deals for the ag sector.
We just opened Argentina to American pork for the first time in a quarter of a century. India and Morocco have both opened their markets to our poultry exports. Japan opened its market to U.S. exports of potatoes from Idaho and lamb from the great state of Texas. Yes. U.S. beef has been shipped to Brazil for the first time since 2003. And we opened China to American beef for the first time in many, many years.
In a speech which lasted more than an hour, Mr. Trump spent nearly half of it not even talking about agriculture, instead using the time to sell his plan to build a wall on the Mexico border. At one point, he invited on stage Jim Chilton, a rancher from Arizona whose property backs on to the US-Mexico border. Mr. Chilton, clearly a fan of the president's plan.
I would say we need a wall all around, all the length of the border. I've traveled around the world, and the biggest wall I've ever seen is around the Vatican. Now, you can't tell me that the wonderful priests and officials of the Roman Catholic Church, including the Pope, are immoral. They have a wall. Why can't we?
Donald Trump assured the audience of farmers that while the wall is designed to keep out illegal immigrants, he was supportive of the ag industry's need for foreign workers to help with harvesting.
You know, when we have proper security, people aren't going to come, except for the people we want to come, because we want to take people in to help our farmers, etc. Very important. We're going to make that actually easier for them, to help the farmers, because you need these people. I mean, I'm glad I told you that, because, you know, look, you're in that business, and a lot of people don't understand this. You need people to help you with the farms. And I'm not going to rule that out. I'm going to make that easier for them to come in and to work the farms.
Away from the wall, Mr. Trump said his government was busy cutting red tape for farmers and simplifying laws around water. Just before Christmas, the president signed off on a multi-billion dollar farm bill, which he said was already delivering benefits.
The Farm Bill delivers for our farmers on a wide range of key priorities. On critical farm programs such as crop insurance, you will have the support you need to plan for the future. It increases the amount farmers can borrow so you can expand and improve your businesses. It also secures the $600 million commitment we made to build a modern, effective, rural broadband across America's heartland. You're not well serviced. To all of the farmers here today and across our country, the greatest harvest is yet to come. The future for America's farmers is bigger, better, bolder, and brighter than ever before. God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much, everybody.
You've always got to hang on to your hat when he's speaking. That's U.S. President Donald Trump speaking at the 100th annual convention of the American Farm Bureau Federation.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Where it's nearly 20 past 12. Now, summertime means seafood and cocktails with plenty of fresh lemon. But you might have noticed that the prices for the fruit have skyrocketed. There's a lemon shortage at the moment, and as a result, lemons are selling for as much as $8 to $9 a kilo, and that still stands. I've just checked out prices at one of the large supermarkets. Lemons are selling for $8.90 a kilo online right now. Chairman of Citrus Australia, Ben Cant, told Jessica Schremer, demand for the fruit is high at this time of year.
So over the summer period, Australia predominantly consumes USA Egyptian and Spanish imported linens, the market certainly tightens a lot. And what happens is, since the exchange rates changed with the US, because we predominantly run on USA linens as imports, that's meaning that the cartons of lemons are up to double the price of what they were when Australian lemons were during the season.
And are we seeing a higher demand than in previous years around that time of the year in Australia?
Traditionally, the Christmas period is a high demand period, basically because of all the seafood that people eat at Christmas time, and then also there tends to be probably, as we all know, a higher consumption of alcoholic beverages and cocktails that require lemons. So our lemon consumption is increasing, but our production is also increasing. Unfortunately, this is just the time of the year due to Mother Nature where we can't produce enough lemons.
And looking at that, is the Australian citrus industry trying to counteract that? Are more plantings going into the ground?
Certainly significant degree of planting activity that's occurred in the last 5 years, and there's going to be increasing volumes of Australian lemons. Unfortunately, as we all know, as we've all experienced with the heat lately in the Riverland, you can imagine what it would be like being a poor lemon hanging on the tree. You'd be ready to melt. So certainly because of our climate, the fruit just isn't able to hang on the trees over that period. So in about 80% of the fruit is yielded by the tree over the winter period, with some in summer.
And Ben, how long are we expecting for this high prices to stay on? When can we expect to see a price drop?
So speaking to some growers, they'll start picking, there's some obviously picking now, but there's not a lot of fruit on tree. The winter crop that will start to come through from the northern areas, which is traditionally the earliest, so in Queensland and, you know, Mareeba, Jimboola, far north Queensland, and then going down to the Burnett region, they'll start picking in February. So we'd see the prices start to come down immediately once the Australian supply kicks in.
Ben Cant, Chair of Citrus Australia. A little bit earlier than Ben predicted, a cold winter did see a gingin farm in the Wide Bay only start picking its lemons now. That's usually they usually start a little bit earlier than that. Abbotsley Citrus grow 50 hectares of lemons, and General Manager Lloyd Foss says so far the fruit is looking magnificent.
Fruit's looking good. Good sizes coming along as well. So, yeah, we're managing to get some decent volumes off the trees, which is great.
How many trees do you have? How long will harvest take?
We won't stop harvesting now right through until April, so we'll carry on all the way through.
That's a lot. How many trees?
We've got just on 50-odd hectares of trees, so yeah, there's a fair bit to go through. We start to pick as well, so we continue to just grazing through the blocks as we go.
If I was a picker, what would you tell me to look for?
Well, at this stage now, we're picking to a minimum size fruit, so any fruit from there upwards in size is we're taking off the trees. Yeah, colour does come into it. So basically what we're doing at this time of the year, we pick it to colour and to size. And then normally within 3 to 4 days, fruit goes through the shed and straight up to the supermarkets and the markets.
You've got enough hands on deck this year?
Yes, we do, but we're always looking for more people, to be honest. At this stage, we're comfortable where we're sitting from a starting point of view.
And where will the fruit be off to?
The fruit now will be going through to the supermarkets. They're always keen to stock Australian lemons, and also to the markets, Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney at this stage. But, yeah, there is a bit of imported fruit around, but that's to basically just keep fruit on the shelves in the supermarkets at this stage.
Anyone that's enjoyed some drinks over the Christmas holidays has noticed that prices for lemons have been quite high. Your timing on that perspective has been excellent.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was just one of the things from a season point of view. Because of the colder winter, everything's just been held back, so... Yeah, that's out of our hands, unfortunately. But from a pricing point of view, yeah, it looks like it's going to be a really positive start to the season.
Lloyd Foss, General Manager of Abbotsley Citrus, and a big g'day to everybody helping out with citrus picking at the moment. It is warming up across the state. It's just ticked over 30 degrees at Bundaberg, which is nearby to Gingin, nearly 40 degrees at Charleville, and 30 degrees at Bowen, further up the coast.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
A cattle company says it will be looking to export more animals from a central Queensland port after the success of its first shipment. Northern Australia Cattle Company says the shipment of 2,200 steers and bulls has arrived in China after sailing from Port Alma near Rockhampton on Christmas Eve. Managing Director Patrick Underwood told Rachel McGee the cattle were sourced from around central Queensland.
The shipment went very well. A lot of planning went into it, of course. It's not a common occurrence for shipments out of Port Alma, so yeah, we did quite a lot of work getting it ready, but as far as sailing, travelling and arriving in China, the shipment went very well.
How many cattle were on that ship?
There was 2,200, predominantly steers. There were some bulls on there, mostly grass-fed cattle and a few grain-fed, but just essentially your premium Queensland beef breed. So there were some Brangus, Droughty, Santa Gertrudis, I guess Brahman Cross, a few Brahmins on there. So it was a bit of typical Queensland cattle, steers around 550 kilograms.
It's been a long time coming to get live exports out of Port Alma. You must be pretty relieved.
Yeah, it is. So we've, North Australian Cattle Company's been exporting to China for a couple of years. We did the first shipment ever out of Australia, and then in January this year we did the first shipment out of Northern Australia from Townsville. So, and then we've been doing them out of Western Australia. So we're reasonably experienced with the China market, but certainly for Port Alma, it's a different area, different quarantine, and you know, a different place to do a ship out of. The fundamental thing about Port Alma is it's very close to Rockhampton, which is the, you know, the cattle capital of Australia, and there's a lot of cattle around Rockhampton. Now, in the past, cattle have been going from Rockhampton, but they go on truck up to Townsville and go out from there. So it does make logistical sense to take a ship to the cattle rather than the cattle to the ship.
Will Port Alma become an important part of your network, and is this more attractive to you guys than, say, Townsville?
To be confirmed, like, we did have a good experience. The support was definitely there.
Has the drought made it more attractive in any way to source and ship cattle out of Queensland, central Queensland?
Yeah, live exports certainly plays a very important role in that. I think having other marketing avenues, you know, for Australian producers. Look, it's just another avenue. Queensland cattle are predominantly going to be processed in Australia. But live exports, I think, provides that other option.
Are there more shipments planned from Port Alma?
Yeah, look, it's Chinese New Year coming up. That's why there's been some strong demand for Australian beef and Australian cattle up to this point. Yeah, we're certainly looking to do some more shipments from February onwards, so we're talking about doing some business.
Patrick Underwood, Managing Director of the Northern Australia Cattle Company. Now, hot, dry weather has seen livestock agents put together a big yarding at the Dolby Cattle Sale today. Coolpy grazier Wendy Sheen at Trinidad Station is one of the vendors, with the roaring drought forcing her to sell 100 young heifers. Wendy says it's the second year she's had to sell off all of her heifers, animals they usually keep to breed from.
We would have kept these to go into our breeding herd, but the season's just not suitable for them. So there's not enough stuff on the ground for them to grow out on and, you know, reach their full potential. We sold the bulk of our heifers last year as well.
What does this leave you with?
A reducing cow herd, which is, you know, the last couple of years have been a bit tough. So if cows are in good condition and empty when they come through the yards, we've been selling them. And we kept 20 heifers last year and sold the rest. And so we've sold all the heifers this year. So age takes a toll on the cows. You can't keep them once they get too old, because this smolga country is not good for old cows. They might be good for another few years on soft green grass, but not on mulga leaf.
It is a catch-22, though, selling your heifers, because you are going to be creating a gap in your breeding herd.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's when it was dry in 02, 03, 04, we had about 240 cows at the finish, and we weren't buying in cows, we were just letting them breed up. But cattle are so slow to breed, you know, 9 months from when you put the bull in before there's any possibility of a calf, and then another 9 months before that calf's really weanable,
mm-hmm.
And then another 9 months before it's probably joinable. They take a long time to breed up.
The drought's been a very long and painful exercise for your family at Trinidad. Who do you think's been holding up better, your cattle or your sheep?
They've both been holding up really, really well. We've been really amazed at how well they're looking, considering how little rain the country's had. The sheep we have been feeding cottonseed to. The ewes, we've only got ewes and we've been feeding cottonseed to them while they've been lambing, and we're feeding some cottonseed at the moment because that we're joining them in the hopes that it rains again. The sheep are a lot easier to feed a supplementary feed like cottonseed too, because you can just put it on the ground and they'll pick up every little bit, and they're really efficient converters of whatever they're eating, and they're really good at foraging. We had a dust storm come through the other night with a lot of wind, and there was a fair bit of leaf fall in the paddock the next day, which the sheep would have picked a lot of that stuff up. But the cattle are doing really well on the mulga with a urea-based supplement to go with it.
Well done, well done. Do you wonder why you're in farming on these kind of days?
Some days. But it'll rain at some point.
You've just got to admire the positivity of Western Queensland graziers. That's Wendy Sheehan from Trinidad Station near Quilpie. And I hope you get a great price for your heifers at the Dolby Cattle Sale today. We've got the details on that coming up soon. Also on the program, graziers fighting the weed Parkinsonia. It grows mostly in the Gulf and the Fitzroy regions. Now have a new arsenal to fight its spread. It's 12:30. Time to check news headlines around the state. Good afternoon, Jodie Gunders.
Good afternoon, Amy. The biggest grain handler for Australia's eastern states says final harvest figures have confirmed yields won't be enough to service local demand. GrainCorp's numbers for the 2018 winter crop have revealed drought conditions continue to affect the eastern seaboard. The total grain delivered to the company's receival sites in Queensland were down to about one-fifth of last year's figures, while grain yields have dropped to a third in New South Wales and half in Victoria. US officials say an American citizen was among those killed in an attack on a luxury hotel and office complex in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. Media reports say at least 15 people are dead. And the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, just has 3 days to produce a plan B for Brexit after a crushing defeat in the Parliament. May's long-negotiated Brexit plan was defeated by an historic margin in the House of Commons early this morning, Australian time. That's quite a deadline, Amy, 3 days.
Imagine the scurrying around. I'm sure they maybe had a backup plan.
Who knows? We'll find out. More news at one.
Thanks, Jodie Gunders. Let's now check the weather with Gabriel Brunesco from the Weather Bureau in Brisbane. Good afternoon.
Hello, good afternoon.
Gee, the temps for the next couple of days are really ramping up, especially in the southwest. What can people expect?
Yeah, but there is no relief from that heat. Although the heat wave condition itself today is the last day, from tomorrow the heat wave itself should ease off or contract just out of the Queensland borders, remaining in the low intensity heat wave, but the temperatures are still forecast to stay high, and really forecast mid 40 degrees, 45, 46 degrees basically over the next couple of days, especially over the Channel Country and Marana, Warrego. Also, we are gonna looking at some low 40s maximum temperatures forecast for central west and northwest.
Is next week much cooler? I can see that it's trying to sneak down a bit.
It will be a cooler trend once this blocking pattern goes away. But still, it is. Not too much, just jumping from like 5, 6 or even 7 degrees above average temperatures in the far southwest, just to 3 or 4 degrees. So we shouldn't really talk about cooler temperatures, just maybe not as hot.
And no rain.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like in the whole state, where we saw some rainfall just in the non-tropical coast, but even there, the rainfall rate dropped compared to 24 hours ago, just 50 millimeters on the tropical coast. Apart from that, not much rain across the state, and in those parts where people experience heat conditions, the rainfall is pretty scarce. We do have some chances of elevated thunderstorm, so there will be some lightning strikes, some flashes, but they will only bring some dust with them instead of some rain, so not much rain at all. And those conditions actually forecast for the next 2 days, and the places just southern parts of central west, also the southeastern parts of Channel Country, the whole Marana, Warrego and Darling Downs, maybe Darling Downs, the Granite Belt, may see some rainfall today with some thunderstorm activity, but everywhere else in the southwest or southern interior, not much, just some dust with those storms.
And winds generally, though, aren't too significant for the boaties along the east coast and in the Gulf?
No, not much winds as well. So it's just northerly, northeasterly winds, about 10 to 15 knots along the southeast coast. Just from perhaps very good conditions for boating, not too rough.
Gabriel Brunesco from the Weather Bureau. Some positivity there in the weather, considering there's no rain on the horizon. Thanks for your time.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Gabriel Brunesco from the Weather Bureau.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, it may have taken 8 years to achieve, but researchers and landholders believe the registration of the first bioherbicide for a woody weed in Australia is a major breakthrough. Plant pathologists for the University of Queensland have harnessed a naturally occurring fungi that causes dieback in Parkinsonia pricklebush to develop a capsule that can now be directly injected into the tree. Parkinsonia is a big problem in the rangelands and is spread from Queensland right through to Western Australia's Pilbara. But as Professor Vic Galea explains to Charlie McKillop, it's the potential to adapt and then refine the new control method that could transform the way woody weeds are managed across the Australian landscape.
Every woody weed out there suffers from some form of dieback. So it's just a matter of finding the right fungi that are doing the job out there in nature, going through the same process of screening, formulating and testing, and we will end up with similar products. So we've got a fair way down the track with prickly acacia, mimosa bush, which is Vachellia finiciana, a big problem down in Moree, so we're playing with that at the moment. We've looked at rubber vine and mesquite as well. Got some really great work with mesquite and they're getting some good results with that in the Pilbara. So yeah, we are constantly working towards that and hopefully we'll have some other products released over the next 3 or so years.
And just in terms of the injection process that you have devised, how might that translate to other products as well? Does it have to be a bioherbicide that goes into it?
Charlie, we've been popping synthetic herbicides into these capsules as well. What we've found is that by putting other compounds into these capsules, we can kill just about everything we've tried or that we've targeted. There are about 6 or 7 conventional woody weed herbicides available, so we've been trialling all of those and some combinations of them as well. And what we've found is that we can get very quick kills using a very small dose that's accurately placed in the stem. Same machine, same type of capsules, just with a different compound inside of them.
Professor Victor Galea is a plant pathologist from the University of Queensland. He spent the past decade or more trying to come up with an effective bioherbicide control for the Parkinsonia prickly bush. If it's naturally occurring, if it replaces other far more harmful sprays, why has it taken 8 long years to get the green light from the chemical regulator, the APVMA?
It has taken a long time for 2 reasons. First of all, the APVMA has never registered a biological herbicide for a woody weed. So for them, it was a first. For us, it was a first as well. So for them, it was developing the guidelines and the recommendations and the hurdles that they required. And for us, it was about collecting the sort of information that they needed. So, it was a partnership.
Professor Galea, you, as a plant pathologist, you've just alluded to the fact that you look out for sick plants. Most of the people in your profession are trying to fix that and make the plants better. And here you are trying to basically, by your own admission, incite an epidemic. How does that feel?
Well, it's all about the question at hand and, of course, the need to solve a problem. When I see the scourge of woody weeds across our landscape, it really sickens me, to see how woody weeds are overtaking our environments. So turning that to my job as a plant pathologist, I focus on the fact the weed is a target and it's a problem and we need to eradicate it, and a biological approach can give us another tool. It's been a learning curve. As a plant pathologist, I really had no idea that I would get caught up in in these sorts of processes, but it's also been a wonderful experience.
Professor Vic Galea, who, after an eight-year wait, is excited to finally be taking dieback Parkinsonia to the market in a partnership between the University of Queensland's commercialisation arm, UniQuest, and Bioherbicides Australia. So, just how big a breakthrough is this for landowners and managers for whom woody weeds are such a constant problem? Charles Curry is a project coordinator with Desert Channel and Southern Gulf NRM. He reckons it's great there's going to be a new product in the toolkit against Parkinsonia, but he told me prickly acacia is still the main game.
It's an effective method on, certainly on Parkinsonia in denser clumps. It provides a longer-term solution because it ends up being a fungus, it ends up in the soil and, as far as I know, can infect future Parkinsonia infestations or new crops of it.
Now, you've seen this product in action. In fact, I understand you've injected the little capsules into the trees. What have you observed or what are your impressions of the impact it's had?
For the most part, it's been very effective. Not in all cases. There's some sites where it just didn't take up, where inundation sites didn't seem to take it up too well, but normal sites which aren't subject to much inundation seem to spread slowly but surely through the clump.
And as someone, Charles Curry, who's had a fair bit to do with trying to get rid of Parkinsonia, how does having a bioherbicide compare with some of the existing chemical and mechanical treatments?
Well, it's obviously not as quick, but with Parkinsonia it's a long-term thing. You can get quicker results, obviously, mechanically or with the tried and true herbicide methods, but this is a good alternative, that's for sure, to stick around in the soil and take care of future Parkinsonia infestations at that site and nearby.
What about in terms of the actual application of the product?
Well, in the early days, we were doing it with a drill and manually sticking the capsule in and then sealing it up. These days, they've developed a very handy tool which penetrates the bark of the Parkinsonia and injects the capsule at the same time. It's a lot less arduous, I can assure you.
And what are your hopes now, Charles, as somebody that's been intimately involved with fighting woody weeds alongside many landholders in the Desert Channel and Southern Gulf Country? What are your hopes for this particular product now that it's become the first bioherbicide to be registered and now advanced to the commercialisation stage?
Well, I think it's excellent for people with Parkinsonia problems. I think a much bigger problem is prickly acacia across desert channels and southern Gulf regions. And it would be very nice if that particular team could come up with a similar thing for prickly acacia. That would be a good long-term result if they could find something that infests prickly acacia on a large scale.
The team seem pretty confident that that could happen. How excited does that make you?
Anything to get rid of prickly acacia gets me excited, I can say that.
Charles Curry from Southern Gulf NRM, who's excited about anything that'll take down woody weeds in that neck of the woods.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's nearly a quarter to one. A Queensland dairy farmer has criticised the dairy industry's mandatory code of conduct for not going far enough and including the retail sector. Kingaroy farmer Damien Tessman says there's a lot to like about the draft code, which was released by the federal government yesterday. But he says it's missed an important opportunity to hold the retail sector accountable.
I really believe that the government has squibbed the opportunity to include all of the supply chain in this mandatory code, and that is from the farm gate level to the processors, but then, of course, to the retail level. There's three steps in order for the litre of milk that I, you know, get out of a cow in the morning, there's three steps before it gets to the consumer, and we've got to cover all three steps, farmers, processors and retailers, so Coles and Woolworths, and, you know, it's been left out. And that's one of the key issues with the mandatory code, is if that's left out, it leaves a lot of issues to do with the profitability and the fairness of the industry has simply been ignored. And I think that's a point that no farmer should ever give up on any minister or any member of parliament they come across. Bang that into them, because it is singly the biggest issue facing our industry, is that retailer activity. But in saying that, there's some really good points outside of that that I think are really worth looking at.
Does it create a bit of an imbalance in bargaining power by not including the big multinational or corporations such as Coles and Woolworths? Is that where the issue is? Do they really need to be a mandatory part of the code of conduct?
Well, what really gets me annoyed is the fact that they have a voluntary food and grocery code of conduct, and the fact is that they're allowed to do what they're doing now with dollar a litre milk. Clearly that's not working. I mean, what's the point of having that system in place if it's not working on their end? And that's what's put up, you know, as the reason why they're not included in this one, is because they have their own voluntary code at that Food and Grocery Council level. But it's clearly not working if supermarkets can engage in really what is predatory pricing. You know, they are going, they're trying to lessen competition on the grocery shelves. And the fact that even companies like Coles drag their feet and they still are giving farmers a lot of trouble with the 10 cent a litre drought levy shows that they are welded to this dollar a litre milk methodology, campaign, propaganda, whatever you want to call it. They are welded to it like you wouldn't believe. And clearly there is an issue there, but the fact that the ACCC hasn't got itself involved in it to fix it, that's been the biggest issue. We can't generate any momentum for change because the ACCC has refused to get involved at the retail grocery level, and I think that's a real issue for farmers on the ground. There is some really good stuff in what's coming out, I mean, particularly around the standard release date for pricing from processors. I think that gives farmers an opportunity to look at the price that their current processor is giving, and if they see a better price somewhere else, they've got the opportunity to move. I think there's some really good stuff around that, as well as the dispute mechanisms. I think it's still not 100% right, but you know, from the farmer's point of view, but I think there's been some good moves there as well. So there is some good things for farmers in it, but I keep coming back to the retail sector of the entire dairy supply chain is where it's got to be, where a lot of work's got to be done in order for it to really have ownership. Keep saying from the farm gate level to the processor to where it's sold, we should all be in it together. And currently we're not. We're only going two-thirds of the way.
Damien Tessman, a Kingaroy dairy farmer, with his thoughts there, speaking with Sarah Jane Bell. Now, it's been just over 12 months since India imposed a major pulse tariff, which took the Australian export industry by surprise. The move meant finding new homes for grain already on ships at sea and an uncertain planting season in 2018. But it also proved an opportunity to find new markets for Australian pulses, according to Pulse Australia CEO Nick Goddard. And he says just over a year on, while the tariff increases sadly cost the Australian pulse industry tens of millions of dollars and forced the closure of several operators, things are now moving on.
So the first major one was a 30% increase on chickpeas, and that came just on the eve of Christmas 2017. And at that stage, the harvest was pretty much over and shipments had already left the country. Some had already arrived in India, so that was fine. They were cleared at the agreed price without the tariff. But then anything that arrived or was on the water around the time of Christmas was going to be subject to a 30% tariff. Now, contracts have been put in place between Australian exporters and Indian buyers, but as you might expect, at least, a number of the Indian buyers said, well, hang on, I'm not paying 30% more for your chickpeas anymore, so you'll have to find another market for them. But meanwhile, the vessel's on the water, and, you know, it's difficult to find another destination market. So it was quite a challenge this time last year, during the month of January and into February, as Australian exporters were desperately trying to find homes for shipments that were actually on the water, and the Indian buyers had refused to take, you know, to honour the contract. So that's fortunately now water under the bridge, although it's fair to say that the cost to the Australian pulse industry was in the tens of millions of dollars, and unfortunately a number of companies have actually ceased trading since that time. Now, 12 months on, things have smoothed down, and pretty much after that first 30% tariff went on, Indian became a no-go zone for Australian chickpea exporters, and then subsequently lentil and peas, because the the tariffs were too high and we just weren't able to compete with the domestic supply.
Yeah, so you talk about, I suppose, some of those new market opportunities that really there was no option but to find with boats on the water and fingernails getting shorter and shorter this time last year. So where does that leave the industry? I mean, are there long-term possibilities there in other destinations?
In terms of the situation last year, fortunately, Pakistan was heading into a deficit of supply, so a number of the shipments were able to be diverted to Pakistan and the shipments offloaded there at agreed prices. So there was some relief there. But it did enable us to look at new opportunities. Invariably, you can't just knock on the door of a country and supply pulses unless there's already an import protocol in place or an agreement between the Australian government and that importing country. However, where we have had import protocols, we've been able to increase our exports into those countries, which has been good. So things like mung beans, for example, into Vietnam and some of those near Asian countries, whereas invariably we would be sending those to India. As I said, chickpeas into Bangladesh and Pakistan. They are existing markets, but they've been strengthened as a result of this. But fortunately, for most of the crops, and I think lentils is actually the exception, but most of the crops of 2017 harvest have been able to find export destinations. We are still sitting on some lentils from the 2017 harvest, but they are being, homes are being found for those as we speak.
Mm. Now, we've obviously got our fingers, toes and just about everything crossed that we can cross, that there will be good rain across all the grain-growing, winter grain-growing regions, especially in 2019. With growers going into the season, though, Nick, I mean, can they plant with confidence given the current market conditions?
Look, I think the uncertainty remains around India, for example, and the election is not expected for a couple of months, so it could be as late as May in India. With that event, there'll be presumably, expectedly, increased market intervention in the lead-up to that in terms of extension of tariffs and extension of quotas on pulses. But even after that, the Indian crop this year is down on previous years, but still the chance, the likelihood is that they'll have sufficient supply for this year. Now, our crop is obviously harvested in the majority of our crop, so the winter crop, is harvested as we come into November, December, which is ahead of their winter crop. So their winter crop is sort of harvested March, April. So if they look like they might be having a deficit going into 2020, then we're well positioned to be able to meet that. But of course, who knows that at the time of seeding in April. So I think the uncertainty around India pretty much remains, and I think growers they'll retain pulses in their rotations, but price signals the price signals are reasonably strong, ironically, but just that uncertainty, I think, will temper the enthusiasm. And, of course, we're still seeing reasonably good prices for canola and wheat and barley. So I think we're probably heading back into more typical-type rotations. We would expect pulses to be around 10 to 15% of overall rotations. Last year was probably at the lower end, a little below that, probably about 7%. So we might come back to something like 10% on a national basis of pulses in the rotation. So, look, when you look at the big picture, India is a big opportunity for the Australian grains industry. Yes, we're a few bumps in the road, and there's no doubt going to be more bumps in the road over the next decade or two. But, longer term, let's not take our sight off India.
Nick Goddard, CEO of Pulse Australia, trying to stay positive, speaking there with Tara DeLangraft.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Soon we will be going to the markets, but the inventors of an insulated native beehive have returned from Parliament House in Canberra, where they successfully harvested the first honey. Anne Ross from Hive Haven on the Sunshine Coast says so far the bees have adapted well to the cooler climate.
Oh, excellent. There's really nice conditions down there at Canberra at the moment, and we've been logging the temperature of the hive once a week, and it's almost ideal. The hive sitting around 25 to 30, which is optimum for native bees.
So Canberra's so much colder than up here. What's your plan over winter to keep those bees alive?
We decided that we'll move the bees off site. We'll be moving them over to Sydney. It's my understanding they'll be moved to the Governor General of New South Wales property. They already have Australian stingless native bees there, so it'll be a good fit. They have an experienced native beekeeper there, so that's what we'll be doing for this winter. Next winter, we may possibly keep a hive in Canberra over the entire year. We would fill the hollow insulation cavity with water and insert the fish tank heater and hook it up to mains power and leave them there.
I've seen a lot more hives for native bees generally on farms. How widely are they being used now?
I think there's a lot more interest in them, especially because they're quite maintenance-free virtually. You don't even have to harvest the honey if you don't want to. And I think the farming and horticultural industry are starting to realise that they're going to have to be responsible for their own pollination into the future. So it's going to be like buying a bag of fertiliser or a tractor or whatever. Pollination is going to be, you know, part of their bottom line in the future.
And what are the benefits of using native bees in agricultural enterprises?
They've evolved with a lot of our species that we're now pursuing as horticultural crops. For example, the native bee and the macadamia are a perfect fit. They're proving now that they are a better pollinator of the macadamia, so that's a plus. There's other advantages than stingless native honey for a value-add product for a farmer. You only have to harvest it once a year. And then the propolis, or the correct name is cerumen, but it's an amazing product which the bees make from resin, and we're going to see a lot more about that in the future. I think it's highly antibacterial, microbacterial, and the University of Sunshine Coast have done a lot of research on both the native honey and the propolis. And I think for a farmer looking for a great mix of pollination and value-add product, a huge potential lays in the future of the native bee.
So interesting. Anne Ross from Hive Haven on Queensland's Sunshine Coast speaking with Jennifer Nichols. Big numbers at the first Dalby cattle sale for the year, where Doug Robson has the details.
Good afternoon, Amy. A month between sales and the continually dry weather conditions resulted in a large yarding of 8,021 head of cattle at Dalby this week for the first sale of the year. Consignments of cattle were drawn from far western Queensland, New South Wales, along with the usual local areas. The yarding consists of a fair penning of cows, not all the bullocks and steers, not many of them. However, there was large numbers of yearling cattle yarded. Compared to the last sale of 2018, prices were cheaper, although good quality feeder steers were selling reasonably well. Medium weights topped out 300 cents for an average of 279. Heavy feeder steers sold at 270 cents so far. Only a few grown steers have been sold, and so far the feeders have ranged from 234 to 268. Grown heifers have topped out 256 cents. There was a large percentage of plain cows through the sale, but all the usual buyers operated this week in a much cheaper market. Two score cows have averaged 171 cents. Medium weights three scores averaged 191, while heavy cows have topped at 223 cents for an average of 211 cents. This is Doug Robson, Dalby.
And over to the Charters Tower Selling Centre, where Mick Kingham says yearling steers sold to 253 cents.
Good afternoon, Amy. There was 1,138 cattle for Charters Tower's combined selling agents, comprising of several lines of mixed quality planer cattle, with many lines coming from western areas. Two processors were absent, along with one feeder buyer, with very limited restocker demand on the day. The Vela steers sold to a top of 277, with some very good lines averaging 252, and yearling steers sold at 253 cents to average 246, with limited demand across the board. Light heifers, Vela heifers sold to 180 to average 169, and yearling heifers sold at 200 cents to average 181 to return into the paddock, and feeder heifers average 179 cents. Some good grain steers to the sorter sold at 271 cents, and heifers to 231, with a limited number of ox selling to 282 cents, with an average of 275. C3 cows were in limited supply, selling to 223 to average 221, and D3 cows sold to 208 to average 197, with two scores averaging 182 cents. Heavy bulls sold to 259, with most sales from 220 to 250 cents. This is Mick Kingham for the National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Mick, and we look forward to more reports from you this year. And that is the Queensland Country Hour for today. Thank you for your company. Ali Felton-Taylor will be with you in the hot seat tomorrow. Take care and keep cool in the meantime. It's news time, 1 o'clock.